You're on the air. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, who is this? What's going on?
This is Jay Nolan from Bowling Green. We're on 46th in time at Times Square across from a Mamma Mia poster, and we're about to be arrested.
Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
We didn't do anything. Community lockdown. We were walking by. We wanted to see what was going on, and all of a sudden we got shot in the chest. We're being surrounded. Cops are putting up a orange sheet or something.
You're listening to a broadcast from the New York City Indy Media Center during the protests at the Republican National Convention in New York. New York City IMC took live reports from the ground round the clock throughout the protests and posted some of the audio on their site.
People are asking questions. A lot of people have NLD hats on.
So the lawyers are also getting arrested, it seems like.
Excuse me?
The lawyers are also getting arrested?
Yeah. It looks like we're all going to get arrested, and they don't look like they're going to let us out.
Today, we will speak with two Chicagoans who were arrested at that protest. We will speak with Professor Lawrence Wittner, author of an article titled The Power of Protest in the July-August Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And we will examine a recent hearing at the Institute of Medicine, where public access to vaccine data was questioned. But first, some local stories.
Affordable housing is disappearing due to development and real estate escalation, and the crunch is affecting people in cities across the country. On a sunny day in late August in Chicago, the Balanced Development Campaign rallied hundreds of protesters to march to City Hall and push for a balanced development ordinance that would lock in affordable housing. For the third year in a row, they were completely ignored. Father Michael Herman is one of the organizers.
We keep hearing that Chicago is a city that works, but there's no place for the workers to live. Who's going to do the work? So we're saying, you know, we're here today to say Mayor Daley and the city council has to pass a balanced development ordinance to assure that we continue to have affordable housing for the workers in the city.
Father Herman says the first year his group showed up to march, they were alone. This year, a diverse array of groups that cross ethnic, religious, and geographic boundaries are joining the campaign, as more and more of the working and even the middle classes are being squeezed out. As Chicago demolishes its notorious public housing projects and new developments replace once affordable rentals, the city is facing a shortage of nearly 50,000 units.
Each community is affected in a different way, so some of the Northside neighborhoods are all being displaced. Other communities are being overcrowded because of the displacement in some of the Northside neighborhoods. And also you'll find some people from Lakeview, from a very kind of gentrified community, kind of upwardly mobile community, also standing with us today saying that really affordable housing is an issue for all the city.
Diane Lemus from the Albany Park Neighborhood Council has also been a member of the Retail Clerks Union for over 20 years. She says the carpenters, teachers, needle trades workers, restaurant and hotel worker unions have joined because their members are being priced out of the city.
It's the members, our membership in the unions, that are suffering the most because of the lack of affordable housing. It's the janitors, it's the retail clerks, it's even the teachers, the policemen, all these people that are strong union members that are suffering because they can't find affordable housing to work, to live near where they work.
Campaign organizers hope to focus public and media attention on the problem and force Mayor Daley to approve a city ordinance that will mandate set-asides so that 15% of new development, even building rehab projects, will contain low- and middle-income units. The mayor refuses to discuss or even consider the ordinance, except to say that mandatory set-asides will kill development and hurt the people it's intended to help. Father Herman from the Balanced Development Coalition.
We have tried to communicate with Mayor Daley for some 3 years now, requesting a meeting. We have got as far as talking to members of his staff, but even bringing religious leaders downtown and union leaders, always requesting to speak with him. We have never even so much as gotten a written response from the mayor on this issue. It's an amazing issue. I've written on many other issues and I get a letter in a couple of weeks. But on the housing issue, never have we gotten a response from the mayor to actually meet with us and to talk about how we can have some type of inclusionary zoning here in the city of Chicago.
Michael Malley, professor of urban sociology at Roosevelt University, says that Daley has indeed pursued aggressive development policies.
Once you set yourself on a track towards development, it's really hard to pull back from it and say, yeah, you're right, we're displacing people. Or the tendency is to say, we're doing this, but it's for the good of the community, and not recognizing that there are negatives for some people. Part of it's clearly a power issue about who has the largest say of, say, ownership in a community. And this is a debate that goes on forever in communities. Are the people that are renting there, are they the community? Or are the real authentic voices of the community the people that pay taxes and own homes and frequent certain stores?
The Balanced Development Coalition is two aldermen short of passing the ordinance in the city council. However, Mayor Daley's support is crucial in a town known for aldermen who rubber stamp almost all of the mayor's policy decisions. From the trenches, I'm Lisa Smith.
Immigration built this nation was the chant in Federal Plaza on Saturday at a noon rally. Organized by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, along with community organizations and activists representing the Filipino, Latino, Korean, Muslim, Arab, South Asian community, and the religious and labor sect. Joining the rally were marches that began in Pilsen and Humboldt Park and a dance troupe, where the crowd culminated to about 4,000 to 5,000 people. A diverse lineup of speakers raised issues that immigrant communities face. Voter registration was one of the issues, and the need for those who can vote to give a voice for those who cannot. They also spoke about the legalization for the undocumented, the separation of families due to deportation, work visas expiring, or policies such as the one affecting Carmen Estacio, a citizen and immigrant from the Philippines who petitioned for her son to enter the U.S. in 1991. Because of immigration policies, he must wait 20 years before he can come to the U.S. Natalie Hamdi told how her husband was racially profiled and detained for a crime he didn't commit. Despite that he was found innocent and also married to a U.S. citizen, he was still deported to Morocco. Deanna Mora, a student from U of I, talked about being undocumented and still able to go to school because of House Bill 60. Unfortunately, under this bill, she is not able to apply for financial aid, which is needed for most students. Despite being undocumented, she, like many others here today, has helped register immigrants to vote. Juan Salgado, president of Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, said, "Stand up, be counted, register to vote." Besides the push to vote, many people expressed participating in the rally was another way of working in solidarity and being proactive on immigrant issues. From the trenches, I'm Tina Hernandez-Laschetti.
Former police commander John Burge was forced to answer questions this month about his involvement in police torture before he was fired from the Chicago Police Department in the early 90s. Burge reportedly took the Fifth Amendment for hours in the deposition, which is part of the lawsuit filed against the city by four men who were released from death row in 2003. Burge is accused of using beatings, suffocation, and electrical shocks to extract false confessions from the men. A 1990 report by the Office of Professional Standards, a police investigatory agency, confirmed that physical abuse in the CPD during the late 1970s and 80s was systemic. Some would say that abuse of power by police has not ended. This month, the Chicago Tribune reported that the death of May Molina Ortiz, an anti-police brutality activist, was an accident, and that a toxicology report confirms she was intoxicated with heroin at the time of her death. Molina Ortiz, who died in police custody after only 48 hours in lockup, was arrested for heroin possession, although what police said was heroin in her possession turned out to be candle-making supplies. Her son Michael, who was also arrested for drug possession at the time, was released for lack of evidence. The Ortiz family did not want to comment on the Tribune article due to the lawsuit they are mounting. However, Annabelle Perez, a friend and fellow organizer, was willing to speak out. Perez is also a member of Families for the Wrongly Convicted. She said the toxicology report is a cover-up.
I know that she was not intoxicated. I know this lady had medical problems, okay? they choose to use this as a cover-up for what they did. Whether they put drugs in her or not, we do not know. I'm not a judge, and I'm not going to judge them. But I know that May Molina had nothing, no drugs in her system. May had nothing to do with drugs. May was always protesting against the police. She was always in the spotlight. You know, if she had, if they let her die, they let her die in her cell, and they said that she had drugs, they would have seen that she was sick, regardless what. They should have seen that she was sick through the, they said they had monitors. They should have seen that she was sick, and the lady was, must have been sitting there. She was there for 2 days. She could not pick up her legs to lay down, so you know she was not laying down. So she had to be sitting down for the fact that she couldn't pick up her legs. She had to be sitting there, and what could she do, lean her head against the bars? They had to see that, and they had to see that they needed to take her to the hospital. Well, we need to do something with this lady, because while their family came over here for the medication, the attorney recommended it, we should take her. But they didn't, and they're using that as a cop-out. They were probably just messing with her, and they didn't figure that she was that sick to die. But she died, and she died in their hands. Mm-hmm. And it was their responsibility. Any human being that goes to the police station, if you see that they're sick, yeah, that's why you are back there monitoring them, and you should be able to tell whether they're sick or not. Mm-hmm. And if somebody else is telling you they are, you shouldn't take a chance with that life.
Perez says Molina's death has chilled police brutality organizing.
It sure has. It sure has. May was the go-getter. She was the motivator. She was the one that was out there. You know, we got to do this. And it's not like that anymore. It's not that it's not like that. It's not as the way it used to be.
At the time of her death, May Molina was fighting for a new trial for her son, Salvador Ortiz, who was still in prison. Perez, who was fighting for her own son's release, says Molina Ortiz gave her strength.
She did everything with me. I mean, I did everything with her. I mean, she would wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning, Annabelle, what are you doing? This is our schedule. This is what we got to do. Are you with me? And I'm like, yeah. And I would get up and go do what I had to do, you know. And it's a big part of me that they took. And, you know, she helped me so much with my son. And now my son's got two natural lives, and I'm trying to fight for my son. And she was my moral support. She was my strength. Because it is very hard to fight for somebody when the system does not allow you, give you not even a bit of a chance to prove your innocence. Mm-hmm. They lock every door that you have, that you knock on, as to try to just try to prove. You know, they ain't going to lose nothing by you showing your case. But they don't allow you to do that. They don't give you that chance. So it's so hard, and I know May was everything to me. She helped me so much, and she's greatly missed.
From the trenches, I'm Rita Sand.
How's it come to this? Oh, 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 oh. Original pirate material. You're listening to the streets. Lock down your aerial. How's it come
to this? This is the A-Noise Daily Roundup. A-Noise is the web stream covering the protests around the Republican National Convention in New York City. I'm Kat Aaron with Rise Up Radio from the New York Indie Media Convergence Space.
New York City's Independent Media Center set up a convergence site to handle the flow of information to the public about what was happening at the protests outside the Republican National Convention.
An estimated 500,000 people took to the streets of New York City Sunday in a massive protest against the Bush administration. The march, organized by United for Peace and Justice, began and ended at Union Square in Lower Manhattan. Jesse Jackson spoke at the march's kickoff.
We're not better off economically. We're less secure emotionally, and yet we're resilient. We fight back.
Let nothing break our spirits. End the war in Iraq, and come November, vote with a passion. Forward by hope, never backwards by fear. Keep hope alive.
The march was largely peaceful, with many people bringing their children to the permitted demonstration. Energy in the street was high, as Andrew from KBOO Radio reported from Union Square.
today has stepped off a little early. It's about 20 to noon, and it's kind of controlled mayhem. No confrontation, but it's just really, really crowded. Spirits are very, very high, and I am not sure the last time I've seen a crowd this size.
The marchers passed by the Madison Square Garden Convention Center on their route. A noise was taking calls via cell phone from the streets.
The march is full strength and moving up here. The street is absolutely packed. Opposite the street from me is Macy's, and there is basically like a large television screen, which the marchers have full view of, and they're airing Fox News live. And it's great. Every once in a while, George Bush will come up on that screen, and the entire street fills with booze. It's pretty fun.
Among the celebrity attendees at today's march were Michael Moore and Jesse Jackson, who both joined arms with United for Peace and Justice's Leslie Kagan in front of Madison Square Garden, where Republican delegates will converge tomorrow. But not all the stars were treated well by New York's Boys in Blue. A Noise spoke with filmmaker Josh Bennett.
We've been shooting this film, This Revolution, directed by Stephen Marshall, for the past 2 weeks in New York. We've had all the proper permits and licenses. The city was aware of our shoot. They were aware we'd be shooting out in the protest. Two of our actors were arrested for wearing masks in public, despite the fact that we had permits which allowed us to shoot. We had Rosario Dawson, who is a major film star, arrested. Our actors were thrown on the back of the squad car without any notice as to why they were being arrested, and they were handcuffed and not given a reason, put in a truck, and only now are they telling us that wearing the mask was against New York code regulations for protesting.
Like actress Rosario Dawson, many others were arrested at the demonstrations in what seemed like almost random arrests. People on bikes were particularly targeted, following Friday's enormous critical mass bike ride where over 230 people were arrested. A call into the A Noise broadcast describes one such confrontation.
We were taking a ride together, a few hundred of us, obeying traffic laws, and at around Herald Square, a bunch of undercover detectives on scooters started swarming into the group of people on bikes and nudging their tires and hitting them with their bikes. The ride split up. A group of people went down 37th, and the DTs on the bikes tackled them, hit them with their bikes, jumped off the bikes, and violently apprehended a lot of them.
The National Lawyers Guild told A Noise that they can confirm approximately 140 arrests Sunday for a total of about 430 people since the protests began on Friday evening. And that's some of the latest. The streets of New York were wild Tuesday on a major day of direct action. At least 900 people were arrested for a total of 1,460 arrests since the protests began Friday.
All week, A Noise reported from New York City's indie media site on the protests largely ignored by the mainstream media.
From Ground Zero to Sotheby's on the Upper East Side, New York erupted today in a series of spontaneous acts of civil disobedience. Following two historic days of jubilant demonstrations, protesters transformed the streets into zones of resistance throughout the city. Christina Heatherton and Tariq Karula have a summary of the day's events.
At 3 p.m., the War Resisters League began a peaceful funeral march honoring all those who have died in the war. The march began at Ground Zero and was supposed to end at Madison Square Garden. Half a block into the march, police corralled participants, arresting over 200. By 7 o'clock, the remaining marchers joined nearly 1,000 protesters converging just south of the convention center. There, protesters performed a massive die-in.
Earlier in the day, demonstrators congregated at Union Square, a park on the Lower East Side of town. By 5 p.m., reportedly 1,000 protesters were moving north towards the convention center, met by intense police resistance. Peaceful participants were corralled by police. When the order to disperse came, protesters enclosed in nets were unable to move. Dozens were arrested. Bill O'Reilly of Fox News has a habit of telling his guests to shut up who present anti-Bush, anti-war, or anti-corporate opinions. The favored catchphrase has come to symbolize a larger silencing of independent voices by the corporate media. Today, groups such as Code Pink and the Ronald Reagan Home for the Criminally Insane decided to organize a protest to give it back to the network. Demonstrators stood outside of the Fox News Network studios chanting, shut up for hours. Many reported being struck and tossed violently by police while handcuffed. Secret, with Portland Indie Media, spoke with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink.
Well, I'm here to say that Fox News is one of the corporate media that has done the worst job in telling the real situation post 9/11, and that thanks to corporate news and the misinforming of the American people, we're in the situation that we're in today. And I think if we are going to get our democracy back in any way, it's going to be by fighting to have a media that really has to tell the truth or else their access to the public airways get yanked. But I was also a victim of the police right now, right here, as I was following a colleague who was being arrested and asking why she was being arrested. I got handcuffed, thrown against a paddy wagon, stuck inside, and taken where they questioned me about why I was here and what I was doing. So I think in addition to protesting what the media has been misinforming the public, we've also got to keep protesting against a government that is repressing our right to free speech.
Finally, the woman and man in black bloc staged a protest at Sotheby's Auction House. Republicans had an exclusive celebration of Johnny Cash for the Tennessee delegates inside the famous auction house. The event was sponsored by the American Gas Association, a multinational corporation whose membership includes gas companies in Brazil, Korea, and France. Over 500 protesters convened in defense of the honor of the late singer, who they say, quote, sang for the poor, the imprisoned, and the oppressed.
And that's a summary of the events of Tuesday, August 31st in New York City.
And the protests continued throughout the week. Nearly 2,000 people were arrested overall, including some Chicagoans. Charles Shaw was there to work on a documentary film and to participate in some of the protests. He said that of the estimated 1,000 Chicagoans, about 15 were arrested. Shaw was arrested on Tuesday and spent most of his detention at the notorious Pier 57, dubbed Guantanamo on the Hudson. He was one of the last protesters released.
I was one of the last eight people dragged out of there.
How many hours did you spend in jail?
46.5, which is 22.5 hours past the time under New York law that you're supposed to see a judge.
During that time, were you allowed to make a phone call or to visit with a lawyer or any family members?
Yes, no, and no. Phone calls were provided to some people once we got to Center Street, which again was a good 30-some hours after we had been detained. And the only way that they allowed you to make a phone call is if your arresting officer was present. And most of the arresting officers had gone home. They had already done 12-hour shifts, 18-hour shifts. So they weren't around, so we couldn't make phone calls.
Did you get the sense or did you hear from any officials that you were being kept for a particular reason?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even the police who were walking around, I don't know whether they knew that they shouldn't have been saying it, but, you know, they'd say, you guys aren't getting out of here until after Bush talks. And, you know, considering that we've learned now that the pier was actually leased by the Republican National Committee, and they paid for it, and they paid for, you know, all the amenities that were put inside, and they knew all along that they were going to try to hold as many of us as possible until the end of the convention. And it's just abundantly clear if you take a look at it. There was so much spin on what was going on and so little coverage that most people just have no clue what happened. And I was there for 2 full weeks, and I would participate in every action during the day. I would witness it. I was filming a documentary, so I'd have footage of it. And the next morning in the papers, you would read 180 degrees different. You would read something that was completely one-sided, that was talking about the police being savaged by thugs and all this stuff. And, you know, the only violence that went down that week was the police on protesters. And that never got reported. There was a near riot on Monday night at the Poor People's March, and nobody covered it.
Giuseppe was there. Giuseppe, a former New Yorker, now lives in Chicago. He was arrested at the Poor People's March on Monday and witnessed how the police violently ended a peaceful march.
Suddenly, some riot police ran this zigzagged barricade through the crowd and straightened it, cutting the crowd into two parts. Then there had been about 30 or 40 unmarked scooters, police scooters with plainclothes cops that had been at a lot of the events and a lot of the protests for the last few days. We had known that they were police because at some points they had pulled out their badges from underneath their shirts, and at other points they were simply colluding with the police too closely to be civilians or whatever. And they started running into the crowd. They actually drove into the crowd and hit myself and others that I know. And one actually ran over a young woman's foot and crushed her ankle, literally driving into a 25-deep crowd, So then the police that were in the riot line that had cut us off from the rest of the crowd started moving in, pushed us down, started beating us, and, you know, we were literally on top of each other. It was chaos. And I want to repeat, this was entirely unprovoked. There was absolutely no reason for us to expect this to happen.
Now, were these officers wearing badges that arrested you? Were you able to get any numbers of the badges?
Well, actually, during my arrest, among the things that happened was, when I was actually arrested, they were busy beating us, but pretty quickly, I was wearing my glasses, which, you know, I have a nice size prescription, I ain't gonna lie, and they hit them off my face, and at that point, I couldn't see, and I have not had my glasses since. I haven't been able to really see since.
Giuseppe and Charles Shaw faced court dates in October in New York City, and both took a financial hit by getting arrested. But Shaw says he was expecting it.
I feel sorry for the people that, you know, were just there to support, but I think that it's important that they got arrested too. You know, the one guy from Wall Street who got scooped up too is going to affect more change than 100 of us activists screaming at the top of our lungs, because this guy, you know, is not of us. And, you know, he wears the suit and makes the money, and when they make noise, people listen.
We're coming to you from the trenches.
The 1,800-plus arrested in New York in August can be inspired by an article published near that time in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Lawrence Wittner, professor of history at the State University of New York at Albany, wrote an article for the Bulletin entitled "The Power of Protest." The article argues that governments gravitate towards using nuclear weapons, and only mass peace movements have slowed them down. I spoke with Lawrence Wittner and asked him about the feeling believed by many that protests don't impact society.
When I began this study years ago, I also had that rather pessimistic conclusion, namely that popular resistance to nuclear weapons, and I knew there had been a good deal of that, had not had much impact upon public policy. That the nuclear powers went merrily ahead building more nuclear weapons, and indeed had developed them without any concern for popular resistance and revulsion against the nuclear arms race. But as I went through the files of the U.S. State Department and the various presidents and secretaries of defense, as I went through formerly secret Soviet government archives, as I went through formerly secret British government archives and other government records and memoirs, and conducted many, many interviews with former government officials, what I learned was that the movement against nuclear weapons had been very effective, that it had curbed the nuclear arms race and prevented nuclear war, that the arms control and disarmament treaties of the past are not testaments to great power interest in these sorts of things, but rather testaments to popular resistance to the nuclear arms race, resistance that had forced the nuclear powers to accept curbs on their nuclear ambitions, and indeed had prevented most countries that could develop nuclear weapons from developing them.
This is very interesting perspective and kind of flies in the face of the kind of popular expositions of nuclear power and indeed of nuclear weapons that we would hear from the media and from our schools. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you would see in some of these declassified internal government planning documents? Any examples come to mind?
Oh, sure. For example, during the Eisenhower administration, during the 1950s, there were constant meetings of the National Security Council, top-secret meetings, and at these meetings, the Secretary of Defense and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would speak up and demand a commitment to the future use of nuclear weapons in future U.S. military conflicts. And Secretary of State John Foster Dulles and President Eisenhower resisted this fiercely, And they said, we'd like to be able to commit ourselves to such use of nuclear weapons, but the public won't stand for it. The public, they said, unfortunately doesn't accept the use of nuclear weapons, and we hope to turn that around in the future, but until we do, we simply can't move forward along these lines.
I had alluded briefly to there being, or at least I'd like to hear what your assessment is. For a long time, it would seem to me that presentations about the use of nuclear power, the development of nuclear weapons, seemed to have a kind of one-sided perspective to them. Like, nothing but good could come from such research and from such development, as it would seem, at least to me, from a reading of the media and from people's regular educations, as being the case. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, I think that the mass media and especially governments carried on a ceaseless propaganda campaign to acclimate the public to the prospect of nuclear war and, at the very least, the building of nuclear weapons and the development of nuclear power plants. But the striking thing is that the public didn't buy that. The public continued to be horrified by the development of nuclear power plants and plans for nuclear war. And there developed mass protest movements in the United States led by such groups as the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, Women Strike for Peace, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and so on, that led public sentiment toward that conclusion that nuclear war and nuclear weapons were disastrous. And therefore, the government, rather than getting ready for nuclear war, should begin to move away from plans for it and indeed begin disarmament rather than further armament.
What do you credit as being the source or origination of these protest movements in light of the fact that there was this seemingly unending torrent of propaganda basically in support of nuclear war? Where did these protests and organizing come from?
Well, I think it was just some degree of common sense. People from the outset, from the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, recognized that nuclear war would be a disaster, and it indeed had been a disaster in 1945. And therefore, despite the soothing words from government leaders, people simply didn't buy it. Small groups began to form against the nuclear arms race right from the start, right in 1945, and indeed even before 1945, inside the ranks of the atomic scientists, many of whom worked on the atomic bomb project during the Second World War, there developed resistance to the use of nuclear weapons. And a good deal of that occurred in Chicago, even during the Second World War, as the Chicago Met Lab functioned as a place where scientists worked on the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project. There was growing resistance to the use of nuclear weapons being produced by some of these same scientists, people like Eugene Rabinowitz and Leo Szilard. And therefore, inside the ranks of the scientists working on the bomb project, there was growing protest against use of the bombs. There were petitions that went around appealing to the president not to use nuclear weapons in the war and warning of the nuclear arms race that would follow any use of these nuclear weapons. And this kind of movement developed after the war into the Federation of American Scientists, into the journal The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and more broadly into a mass anti-nuclear movement in the United States and, in fact, around the world.
One factor that at least comes to my mind as possibly galvanizing additional support in anti-nuclear and especially anti-nuclear weapon efforts are popular movies that depicted what probably would happen if a nuclear weapon would be deployed. A couple of examples that come to my mind. The British filmmaker Peter Watkins actually developed a film which actually won an Academy Award for Best Documentary here in the United States, in which he actually depicted an attack against the a nuclear attack against Britain. And probably here in the United States, more than 20 years ago, the most famous example might be the television movie which aired on ABC called The Day After, which depicted a nuclear attack upon Kansas. Do you think that these kinds of popular expositions helped to fan the flames of anti-nuclear organizing?
I think they did. On the other hand, what's very striking is that the government in the United States and in Britain ferociously resisted these films and they're being shown. And I found that out when I went through the government records. The War Game, for example, was kept off the BBC, although it was produced for the BBC, and couldn't be shown in commercial theaters for decades in Great Britain. The film The Day After was ferociously resisted by the U.S. government, which sought to censor it, and in certain ways did censor it, I should note. That is, U.S. government pressure on ABC television led to the altering of the film and to the setup of a panel after the film showing that was heavily weighted toward proponents of nuclear weapons rather than toward the nuclear freeze campaign, which in fact the poll showed was supported by 70% to 80% of the population. So I think these films were very significant. But you have to look at the context, and the context was mass media's fairly effectively and the government's fairly effectively keeping these films away from the public. Actually, an even more effective film, since it was shown widely, was On the Beach, which was shown during the 1950s and showed the aftermath of nuclear war in Australia as people slowly died from the radiation. And the Eisenhower administration held cabinet meetings to deal with how they were going to counteract the effect of this film. And they were very worried about it, and they sent out bulletins to their various U.S. information officers around the world about how to deal with the public reaction to this film.
Let me follow up with the point you had raised with regards to The Day After. In what ways were the government trying to censor ABC or the filmmakers from showing what I suppose would be an original cut of the movie?
They particularly were annoyed about the fact that the firing of the nuclear weapons occurred because of a Soviet fear of U.S. Cruise missiles, and of course the cruise and Pershing missiles, the so-called Euro missiles, were a hot issue during the early 1980s. And furthermore, just generally, they, as the government realized that this would not be a film that would encourage a nuclear buildup, government officials began to worry that any candid portrayal of nuclear war would simply create supporters of the nuclear freeze campaign. And that's what they talked about inside these secret government meetings. And indeed, the government was given copies of the film months in advance so that it could respond to it and it could develop its public relations campaign to counteract the effect of the film. So that ABC, I think, deserves some credit for broadcasting it, but it's also true that ABC collaborated with the U.S. government, censored the film, and indeed warned the filmmaker that unless he accepted censorship, the film would simply not go on the air. And furthermore, saw to it that the government had plenty of time and plenty of advance notice to develop its counter-information program.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the past. I was wondering if we could change the topic a little bit to the present. Nowadays, the Cold War has ended and the Soviet specter is no more, but you still nonetheless have a nuclear specter very much on the landscape. Examples include, the current Bush administration has been advocating, or at least mentioning, maybe not necessarily advocating, the use of portable nukes. The examples of use of depleted uranium has elicited some concern. And there's been talk of the deployment of nuclear power plants, possibly in the United States, to generate energy and using global warming as an example for this mass deployment. What other possible nuclear deployments or nuclear uses do you see as being advocated by this administration and perhaps future administrations in coming years?
Well, I think that unfortunately, since the end of the Cold War, the anti-nuclear campaign in the United States has declined, and this has given hawkish politicians around the world, as well as in the United States, a chance to revive the nuclear arms race. So that India and Pakistan, for example, in 1998, exploded nuclear weapons, became nuclear powers, and have subsequently threatened one another with nuclear war. The U.S. Senate rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, negotiated by the Clinton administration, indeed signed by the U.S. government and governments around the world. And the Bush administration has rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It's pulled out of the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It is going forward with a Star Wars missile defense, or at least a variant on that. And furthermore, it is now in the process of securing funding from Congress for the building of new nuclear weapons, so-called mini-nukes, bunker busters, as they call them sometimes, and is getting ready with new legislation from Congress to resume nuclear testing more rapidly than it could otherwise do. So that the U.S. nuclear machine is now once more rolling forward. Nuclear arms control treaties are being scrapped, and people who are concerned about the nuclear arms race and indeed future nuclear war, I think, had better get moving once more and begin to protest and resist this, and at the very least contact their members of Congress who are in the process of voting on these things right now and tell them that they don't want new nuclear weapons. The problem is not that the world doesn't have enough nuclear weapons, but rather that 30,000 nuclear weapons still exist in the world, and it's time to get rid of these through controlled arms control and disarmament treaties.
Mm-hmm. With regards to, I guess, this decline in, I suppose, anti-nuclear agitation, you're also seeing, as I had alluded to earlier, protests which we've seen in recent years of scales that probably dwarf anything that we've probably seen in human history of basically against, in this case, opposition against the war in Iraq and related issues to that. Do you think that the protests from the war in Iraq could help to feed an anti-nuclear anti-nuclear agitation? Or where do you see these two trends mixed together, if at all?
Well, I think that, ironically, the Iraq protests and the focus on Iraq by the U.S. peace movement cuts two ways. One way is to simply distract the movement and the mobilizable public from the threat of nuclear war. That is, as people focus on Iraq, they don't look at the Bush administration's proposals in the Republican Congress for building new nuclear weapons and resuming nuclear testing. On the other hand, the protests against the Iraq war have led to the revival of many peace groups. Peace Action, for example, has been growing rapidly for the last few years thanks to the militarism or the threat posed by the militarism of the Bush administration. And groups like Physicians for Social Responsibility in the United States or the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Great Britain and many peace groups around the world are growing as a result of their resistance to the Iraq war. And since these groups are also themselves concerned about the nuclear arms race, they have the potential now for mobilizing people against that nuclear arms race. And to some degree, they do that. mailings from Physicians for Social Responsibility and Peace Action and so on do stress the dangers of the Bush administration in the nuclear realm. So I think the Iraq war cuts two ways.
That was Professor Lawrence Wittner of the State University of New York at Albany. Professor Wittner has written extensively about peace movements, and his newest book completes a trilogy on the struggle against nuclear weapons, entitled Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement from 1971 to the Present. Professor Wittner published an article in the July-August 2004 issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists titled The Power of Protest. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik, and we're coming to you from the trenches.
On Monday, August 23rd, as Congress was on vacation, the Institute of Medicine, or IOM, held a little publicized hearing in order to, quote, review the design and the implementation to date of the new Vaccine Safety Data Link Data Sharing Program to assess compliance with the current standards of practice for data sharing in the scientific community. What this translates to is they were deciding whether or not outside researchers should be able to access the data from this relatively new taxpayer-funded database. What is the Vaccine Safety Data Link Data Sharing Program, otherwise known as VSD? VSD is a collaborative database of vaccination data begun in 1990. The data collected comes from children vaccinated at seven or more large HMOs. Each vaccination is documented and any adverse reactions are input. Although the CDC proclaims on their website that the VSD is open to outside researchers, only one outside researcher so far has been allowed access to the database, and only after intervention by congressmen. Why is the database closed to the public, and why are they reviewing access to the database when only one researcher has seen parts of it? The Institute of Medicine says it's because they are trying to protect the confidentiality of the participants in the study. The researcher who gained access believes otherwise.
The government appears to be engaged in a campaign to cover up concerns about the safety of vaccines under the guise of protecting the vaccine program.
Dr. Mark Geyer, president of Genetic Centers of America.
If the government continues the campaign of attempting to cover up vaccine safety concerns, it's not going to have a vaccine program. Evidence the parents that you see in this room.
Dr. Geyer testified at the webcast hearing that he endured a year-long struggle and hefty expense to gain access to the database. Geyer was particularly interested in reviewing the CDC's data on thimerosal, a preservative in vaccines made of mercury that has come under public scrutiny for possible connections to autism. Thomas Verstraeten, formerly of the CDC, published an article in the journal Pediatrics in 2003 using the VSD. The article claimed that there is no evidence that thimerosal has any relationship to the skyrocketing incidence of autism in the U.S. Shortly after the article was published, Verstraeten left the CDC for a job at GlaxoSmithKline, a manufacturer of vaccines containing thimerosal. When looking at the same database, Geyer found contrary evidence. He compared about 70,000 children who received at least three doses of thimerosal-free DTAP, or diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, and about 86,000 children who received DTAP that contained mercury. He found a statistically significant increased risk for autism in those children who received DTAP with mercury. Geyer presented his preliminary findings at the Institute of Medicine on February 9, 2004, before the IOM Immunization Safety Review Committee.
3 days following our presentation to the Institute of Medicine hearings, Jeannie Santoli, Acting Director of Science and IP CDC, sent a letter to all HMOs that had provided access to their data in the VSD.
The letter accused Dr. Geyer of misusing the data.
In the following months, all of the HMOs that had provided us with a permission to access the data in the VSD database suspended our access. Even HMOs that did not even have data in our VSD. And incidentally, they never sent the letter to us, only to them.
Guyer believes his access should be fully reinstated. At the end of his testimony, he also called for the VSD to be accessible to the public. In addition to Dr. Guyer, representatives of the CDC testified, five in all, while only one person testified from a university-based research organization, one from an HMO, and one from a consumer group. Throughout the day, children could be heard in the background as members of the public waited for their turn to speak. After 8 hours, parents were finally allowed 2 minutes each to testify on whether the database should be closed to outside researchers.
I'm just going to ask my son one question. Who am I? A neurotypical six-year-old would know that I'm Mommy, or at least Terry Small. Okay, sit down, honey. Ian will probably never know American liberty. He doesn't have liberty, but he does have mercury poisoning, and he got it from his vaccines. Today, Dr. Bernier used the rationale that VSD data is organic, not static, implying that not all snapshots of information from the database need realistically be available to the public at every moment.
As contracted
what
by the CDC,
realistic?
Today the Institute of Medicine is being asked to render a decision that could deny future access to the taxpayer-funded vaccine safety data link, which is a direct violation of the Data Quality Act. This hearing comes on the heels of the May 18, 2004 IOM report that rejected a causal relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and the neurodevelopmental disorder known as autism, and made the recommendation that future investigation into the thimerosal-autism association need not be pursued. When has medical researchers ever been told, don't study this anymore?
I'm Laura Bono. I'm chairperson of the National Autism Association. I'm also a mother of a mercury poisoned child. He regressed into autism after his 16-month well baby visit, where he received 50 times the EPA limit for mercury exposure. Limiting access of independent researchers to the vaccine safety data link makes no scientific logic. If the reassurances from our and government, the appointed scientific bodies, and the industry are true, then independent corroboration, possible only by allowing access to the same data, would validate that truth. Not allowing access, not allowing independent researchers the opportunity to use the VSD, only raises questions as to the veracity of their studies and the motivations behind not allowing access.
Good afternoon. My name is Lou Jean Clark. I am a parent of a child damaged by mercury. The flu shot was his toxic tipping point. My husband is a triple board certified physician for the last 30 years. I have worked as a nurse in family practice and OBGYN. And when we first learned that our son had been poisoned by the mercury, we set out to prove that it couldn't possibly be, because the emotional burden we would have to carry as medical professionals that we possibly had inadvertently done this to another family was more than we wanted to think about. So we've gone all around the country, and many of you are becoming familiar with us because we're apt to turn up many places, talking with the researchers. Show us your data. The ones we can't seem to get the data from are the ones that says, no problem. I believe you recognize me, don't you, Mr. Bernier? I said the CDC was going to become the Enron of the vaccine industry. Remember me? Remember how Arthur Anderson told the investors of Enron? We've looked at it. There's no problem. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I've always been proud of the CDC. Don't leave that legacy of mistrust on the CDC. It doesn't deserve it. But a few people who are so desperate to save their careers or to save a program, and I understand not being able to want to acknowledge that you possibly could have been involved in the harm of so many children. But once you do look at the raw data, and once you do acknowledge that there is a problem, you have a moral responsibility to act. Covering it up never solves anything.
30 seconds.
I was the one that did the investigation on the Brighton Collaboration. The Brighton Collaboration is indeed very troubling. It operates as a nonprofit from within side 1600 Clifton Avenue. For those of you not familiar with that address, where is that, Mr. Bernier? That's right. Cover your head, sir. That's the CDC. But where do they run the money through? Through a Swiss bank account. Now, I've lived in Atlanta. I was unaware that they didn't have enough banks to hold all the money, so we must run the money through a Swiss bank account. Well, we will shine the light on Brighton, because it was started by Bob Chin of the CDC. It was started by Philippe Duclos of World Health Organization, Elizabeth Lupi, pharmacovigilance officer, one of my personal favorite titles, pharmacovigilance officer of Adventist Pasteur. Imagine that. Mike Marcy, one of the lead investigators on the Thimerosal VSD program. The light will shine, Mr. Bernier. You can run, but you can't hide. I know this has been called David and Goliath. Read your Bible. David won. Yay.
Those were parents of autistic children speaking before the Institute of Medicine hearing on August 23rd. The hearing was the first in a set of meetings to review the present policies concerning the Vaccine Safety Data Link database. The next meeting of this review committee takes place on October 21st. A footnote to this story. Dr. Mark Geyer, the only outside researcher to access the data in the VSD, found another interesting fact. It seems there's a problem with the data for several of the publications issued by the CDC using VSD data. One in particular caught this reporter's ear. Dr. Geyer wanted to review the data from an article the CDC published on the safety of giving newborns the hepatitis B vaccine. Dr. Geyer.
Safety of neonatal hepatitis B administration. We were informed that the CDC spoke with the study's primary author and determined that the data sets for this study will not be available in a form acceptable for reanalysis. Subsequent communications revealed that the data sets were stored on obsolete media, which we agreed to accept them on. It was then acknowledged that the data set had been damaged. We agreed to fix it. And then finally it was revealed that the data set containing the raw data no longer existed.
Such missing data calls into question whether the data ever existed. While the government lauds this vaccine as the safest on the market, it tops the list in the CDC's own report of the vaccines with the most adverse events reported from 1991 to 95, and is second only to the chickenpox vaccine from 1996 to 2001, according to VAERS data, or the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, which is open to the public. This year, the Illinois Parent-Teacher Association, or PTA, passed a resolution at their annual state convention calling for an end to vaccination of infants and children against hepatitis B in the state of Illinois. The resolution cites data from the Illinois Department of Public Health that shows more children are injured or die from the vaccine than could have gotten hepatitis B even before the vaccine was invented. This reporter proposed the resolution before the PTA convention in May. From the trenches, I'm Rita Sand. From the Trenches is produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, or find links to news and upcoming events in Chicago and around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Many thanks to WLUW for their continued support. Listen again on the fourth Monday in October for another report from the Trenches.